Okay, so let's talk about astrology, shall we? Because astrology is obviously to do with the stars, and I kind of often look at the stars at night, pretty much every night, actually. And just because they're so beautiful, I went out last night, it was very cold, which meant it was a clear night, and it was all so crystal clear up there, absolutely beautiful. I'm lucky I live somewhere that there isn't too much kind of ambient light. And I could really see everything going on, all of that. And it was really kind of just a beautiful sight. I'm not very good with the stars, to be honest with you. I can only identify usually three objects in the sky, if you like. I can the constellation Orion, which I will be talking about later on, the constellation the Big Dipper, the Plough, as they call it, which is Ursa Major, I think, and then the Pleiades, because the Pleiadians have always figured in Sumerian mythology and stuff like this. And it's interesting that if you look up Orion's belt, follow the line that makes and kind of go up in the sky, you see a smudge in the sky, and that's actually the Pleiades, seven stars and all of that. So I just think they're gorgeous. And I think as well, I'm looking up there and I understand, because I understand somewhat the vastness of space. And we're looking at suns, these stars, and they're so far away, and it's such a grounding experience to think here I am, at least, standing on this little rock, looking up at this enormous universe, and just feeling kind of very sort of diminutive in a way. Because we're kind of reminded when we look up at the sky that we're really such a kind of small part of such a large universe. And what we understand about the universe is very small. I mean, I've done shows on dark energy, dark matter and stuff like that. And we don't understand much about that. They say we understand perhaps, I think maybe 15% of the universe at the moment. And the rest of it we don't. Dark matter and dark energy we don't really understand. Although there's quite a few theories out there and they're working on it, you know. There it is. But I really, as I said, we feel so small about it. Yet, on the other side, we are part of that whole cosmic consciousness. We were created, we evolved as part of that universe. We are an integral part of the universe. So we don't have to feel left out, just a little bit small, that's all. I mean, as I said, so we're a natural product of the universe. We belong. And we might consider, because that then might make some people think, well, then there must be some kind of a spiritual connection. But when I look at the stars, I see energy, right? Nothing divine in that sense, but I see energy. And it is that energy that might be able to explain everything. I'm not so sure, but, you've heard me talk about that a bit. So there's a paranormal connection, of course, but of course that's not supported by science yet. Because who knows that down the road we might be able to understand a bit more about that. I've always had this kind of fantasy, I suppose, that at some point through quantum physics or something like that, they'll get down to a level and they'll go, oh, look at this. We've got electromagnetic fields. We've got the zero-point field. We've got the Higgs field. And now there's another field here, which is the cosmic consciousness field. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's very speculative, of course. But it does make me kind of wishfully think about that sometimes, because that would explain all the paranormal phenomena. But there we are. But even if that hasn't been proved by science, our planet, our little old planet here, does figure importantly in the cosmic mechanics of our galaxy. But we are aware, of course, it has a finite life and will one day be absorbed a billion or so years down the road. And I guess what I'm kind of leading to is that astrology, in a sense, presents that same kind of partial understanding of things back in history. And that's why it's occurred. And the question we're asking here in this show is it still relevant? Is it still real? Does it have, you know, perspective? Can you use it usefully? That's the sort of thing. So that's the information that I'm going to present. And of course, to do that, we need to look at some history. Now, staffscience.uu.nl, Robert H. Van Gent says, Isaac Newton, we all know Isaac Newton, right? Discovered that physics explained the universe better than astrology. Because Isaac Newton was around at the time when developments and discoveries were starting to question what was the standard beliefs at that time, heavily influenced by religion and scriptures and stuff like that, and also by traditional practices and stuff like this. Then they were finding sort of more, what should we say, reality out there in the universe, and then trying to match that against what the current thinking was. Of course, Isaac Newton, as a scientist at the time, you'd expect him to have studied astrology. And it's a question of, was he in secret an ardent student of astrology? Even though there was no direct correlation with the discoveries that were being made. And I mean, one of the things that's often quoted as evidence that in fact he was interested in astrology, at least, is the following anecdote, which is often quoted, which was when the astronomer Edmund Halley, as of Halley's Comet, right? 1656-1742, he once spoke depreciatively on the subject of astrology, gave it a bashing. And Newton said, and berated him with the remark, Sir Halley, I have studied the matter, you have not. And he would talk like that, because I think it was Isaac Newton. I think he was he was head of the Royal Mint or something as well. He did a lot of different things. He was well in with this and well respected. So his opinions would have been very well respected. So there was that question of astrology, which Halley kind of didn't think was relevant, and that Newton thought might have some relevance. You get it. But I mean, there was people like Jean-Baptiste Morin, who was the French court astrologer, who thought that the Earth was the centre of the solar system. Geocentric, they call that. And astrologers ignored discoveries of science. And the problem was, once they did that, they were ridiculed. This is what pushed astrology out into the wings, because instead of doing basically what the church does, to be honest, as new things are uncovered, they move. They change their views carefully and subtly so that they kind of stay relevant. Well, if with astrology you dig your heels in and you say, no, the Earth's the centre, I mean, look at our charts and look at our this and look at our that, then people are going to say, well, that's ridiculous. You must know that the Earth is moving around the sun. And then further, that the sun is moving in the Milky Way and that the Milky Way is moving within the universe. Okay, they may not have got that information till more modern times, but this is the point. They didn't move with the times. So they were ridiculed. And I mean, some of the things, I've just picked one example here, which is a very kind of almost emotional one, I should say. Your Princess Diane, right? We all know Princess Diane. She had an astrologer. And her astrologer told her of the connection to the USA for her sons and famously wrote about that and quoted in newspapers and something. But the astrologer did not tell her, hey, don't go down that French tunnel. You know what I'm saying? So you got to ask, well, what's the relevance? You know, you can say, oh, this is a good week for thinking about things and considering new plans and stuff like that. But how is that useful? And this is, again, what we're discussing right here. Now, according to Wiki, astrology, in its broadest sense, is the search for human meaning in the sky. It seeks to understand general and specific human behaviour through the influence of planets and other celestial objects. It's been argued that astrology began as a study as soon as human beings made conscious attempts to measure, record, and predict seasonal changes by reference to astronomical cycles. So you hear the two words there, astrology and astronomy. We're talking about astrology here. But of course, in those days, you know, people would personify, what's that called? Anthropomorphize such things as planetary objects that they could see. The sun was a god that moved from the end of the sky and moved over. The moon was a counter god that came up during the night. So obviously they were constantly in battle with each other. Or one was the father, one was the mother. Or all these kind of things would come up from people who didn't understand that these were actually cosmic objects. So you can understand that. But of course, astrology, did provide these cycles of seasonal activity and so on. And of course, seasonal activity was quite important. When do you plant the grain? When do you plant the seeds? When do you harvest? This sort of thing. Now, according to astrostyle.com, that I have to say is very pro-astrology, 30,000 to 10,000 years ago BC, the roots of astrology begin with earliest civilizations, and that maps of the stars existed long before maps of the Earth, which makes sense, really, because you can see the sky, you can't see the Earth. You can only see your local vicinity. Archaeologists found cave paintings, mammoth tusks and bones marked with lunar phases. Man has long coped with uncertainty, and the change brought on by nature's cycles by tracking the stars. The first seven visible planets were our first GPS. Bit of a stretch, that. But of course, you know, sailors did use the stars to navigate and stuff like this. 6000 BC, this is from John J. Collins, 1998. He talked about the figure of Enoch, who's a biblical figure. And what they're making the connection is saying that the figure of Enoch was to some degree modelled on a guy called Enmedjeranki. And he was the founder of the Guild of Barbs of Babylonian diviners. And this is divining is predicting the future. So obviously this is kind of important, where people are trying to use some kind of, as I said, artificial means or something like that to actually predict the future. What's interesting is Enoch is listed in Genesis as the seventh in line from Adam. And in the Sumerian king list, the seventh king is Enmedjeranki. So there is that question, was in fact Enmedjeranki the same person as Enoch? Does that explain how it got into the Bible that he was in fact a Sumerian king? Because you know all these places are connected, Sumeria, Babylon, and then what finally became Israel. There was a place called Sippar, which was the city ruled by this king, Enmedjeranki, and it was the centre of the cult of Shamash, which is the sun god. And Enoch, again drawing this comparison, is associated with the solar calendar. His age is given as 365 years in Genesis. That's a number we all know. And the astronomical book contained in 1 Enoch presupposes a calendar of 364 days. So according to Wiki, Babylonian astrology was the first organized system of astrology, arising in the second millennium BC. So this was actually more than just drawing it on the cave walls and stuff like this. This was actually putting together a system that then could be passed down to, apprentice astrologers or whatever. And there's this speculation that astrology in some form appeared in the Sumerian period in the third millennium BC, but the isolated reference to ancient celestial omens dated to this period are not considered sufficient evidence to demonstrate an integrated theory of astrology, but it was at that time that it began to form. The history of scholarly celestial divination is therefore generally reported to begin with the late Old Babylonian texts, so the ones that followed the Sumerians, about 1800 BC, continuing through the Middle Babylonian and Middle Assyrian periods down to about 1200 BC. Now, the history of Babylonian astrology shows the development of astronomical knowledge within the context of divination. There's a collection of 32 tablets with inscribed liver models dating from about 1875 BC, and they are the oldest known details of Babylonian divination. And these demonstrate the same interpretational format as that employed in celestial omen analysis. Let me explain that. So the Babylonians had decided that looking for blemishes and marks found on the liver of some sacrificial animal could be interpreted as symbolic signs, which then presented messages from the gods to the king. They used that same process of looking for those marks, signs, symbols, whatever, to look at the stars to come up with the same kind of divination that again they could present as being signs, indications of the future from the gods to the king. And of course you've got to think, well, if you're the royal astrologer, you want to keep coming up with good stuff. And you want it to be as mystical and celestial and all this kind of thing as possible, so the king stays impressed. And if you word it very carefully and make sure it's fairly generic, then in most cases you're going to be right. You know, well, we looked at this thing in the stars there, and we think tomorrow is going to be a clear day, but there could be some rain. It's like, you know, okay, I get it. So, but that would have been important to keep the astrologer well paid and in good employment, wouldn't it? And so basically, you got to this place where the gods were also believed to present themselves not just in the livers of animals, but actually in celestial images of the planets or stars with whom they are associated. So the origins of much of the astrology would later develop in Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and are found amongst the ancient Babylonians in their system of celestial omens that began to be compiled around the middle of the second millennium BCE. So you get the idea of how that all grew together. Now, that system, of course, then spread around the world. It later spread either directly or indirectly through the Babylonians to other areas such as China and Greece. And we've talked many times on this show about Greece and how it was such a major part of developing cultures and civilizations. And of course, once it came to Greece initially, as early as the middle of the 4th century BCE, before the common era, or whatever that means, BCE, BC, right? And then around the late 2nd or early 1st century, after the Alexandrian conquests, this Babylonian astrology was mixed with Egyptian tradition, because I think Alexander sort of conquered the Egyptians. And so their tradition of what is known as Decanic astrology, which is just using a different number of star groups to look at, 36 in fact, they then came to create what we know to be horoscopic astrology. All right. So what was happening between about the 330 BC and the 5th century AD? We already heard Alexander the Great conquers Babylon, Chaldea, and the Greeks eventually start making advances in astrology. along with developments in things like medicine, geometry, mathematics, philosophy, and so on and so on. And you should know that the modern names for planets and zodiac signs come from Greek literature. So they are the ones that put it together, and they were a very influential and advanced civilization for the time. In 140 AD, a guy called Ptolemy publishes a book called Tetrabiblios, which is one of the most revered astrological works ever written. Now, Tetrabiblios was four books, and it was also known in Greek as the Apotestelimatica effects, and in Latin as the Quadripartitum, because it was four books, quadra, and which means four parts, and it's a text on the philosophy and practice of astrology, written in the 2nd century AD by the Alexandrian scholar Claudius Ptolemy. Okay. So Tetrabiblios, the book he wrote, contains the core techniques of astrology used to this day, including planets, zodiac signs, houses and aspects or angles and different stuff like that. And so really all it required was deciding on what was a system that they could use and then actually using that system to put in a book. Because once you've got a book, then you've got a center for reference so that people wanting to look at this would be able to look at this. And then that kind of standardized the process because you tend to use the ceremonies, the symbols, the aspects, the understandings, the interpretations and so on that were actually in a book. It was easy to pass that book down. The same happens with religious texts. It's easier to go to the religious text and take those things out of there than work it out yourself. It's there in the book. Look in the book. You'll find the answer there. So you get that idea. And really, that went on until the Roman Empire expanded and then contracted when the Roman Empire fell. And Western astrology, which is really where we're aiming, it disappeared for about 500 years. Of course, the Arabs, who were the ones who did kind of continue a lot of this more mystical study and so on, they continued because they weren't affected by the Romans. But basically, the Romans, when they went, it all shut down dead. We call it in Britain, we would call that the Dark Ages. And that's why it's called the Dark Ages, because a lot of that civilization seemed to disappear. But they have found that really it wasn't a dark age. Things continued, but you didn't have that overall influence of that big European force providing stuff from all around the world. So things kind of got smaller and shut down for a while until they expanded under their own steam, which is kind of interesting. So we'll talk about that in a sec.
Have you ever asked yourself why? Well, now you can ask Andy Why. News, views and conspiracy theories.
And this, of course, is Andy Why, Dr. Andy Yates on Beatroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And we are talking about astrology. We've kind of got up to about the time when the Roman Empire fell. And, of course, that was the time that they moved out of Britain. And Britain kind of moved into what they often call the Dark Ages, although they weren't as quite as dark as were thought. In fact, archaeologists, there are quite a few things on like YouTube and places like this that show archaeological investigations of those times and actually show that, no, everything just continued. You know, so what? You still had the cows to milk in the morning. You still had a tin mine that still produced tin. Nothing actually stopped when the Romans went away. They weren't the driving force. And of course, a lot of Romans had already kind of assimilated into British society, so they didn't go away. They just continued and didn't go back to Rome or whatever. Although it is warm in Rome, and I don't feel very warm right now, so I don't know. I might be on my way. But there we are. So, okay, so really nothing much happened with astrology until the Middle Ages. Okay. And of course, so we're talking about the Middle Ages, so we talk about 1,000 years further on, pretty much. And this is the time when advances in mathematics helped astrologers develop more accurate and sophisticated charts than ever. Okay, based on the stars. And many esteemed European universities at this time, including Cambridge, 1225 to 50, had astrological chairs as part of their departments. And the royals, you know, would have had court astrologers. And even many popes were pro-astrology, those that were kind of moving with the times and trying to keep up with things. And of course, if astrology was presenting something from God or whatever, then obviously the Pope would be interested in that. So, but one of the guys, a monk and a mathematics professor, a guy called Placidus, 1603 to 68, created the house division system used by astrologers today. So that's the kind of time you're talking about there. But, of course, there were advances in what you might call science, because like somebody like Copernicus advanced the theory that the Earth travels around the sun. And he kind of got a little pass on that because he dedicated his main work to the astrologer Pope Paul III. So he kind of got a pass because he would have had a lot of religious pushback on that. Belief in astrology began to decline as the church gained power. And it was seen as heresy and superstition during the Inquisition. Well, sort of. Galileo himself was found guilty of heresy and had to renounce his astrological beliefs to save his life, which is true in a sense. But it wasn't that he had to renounce his astrological beliefs, because astrology at that time believed that it was geocentric. So the Earth stayed still and everything rotated around. So it wasn't his astrological interests, it was his astronomical interests. So it was actually his study of the stars that said, no, wait a minute. Earth is moving, so are the other planets. They're moving around the sun. And that was what the church had a problem with. So basically, Galileo, they found him, this is a quote, vehemently suspect of heresy. What on earth does that mean? But you've got to think that this was the Inquisition that was saying this. Well, you didn't mess with those guys. Vehemently suspect of heresy. It's like a lot of the accusations that were made, I don't know, by the about the Russians poisoning the Skripals, which they may have done, but it was all like that. Well, we're absolutely certain that they are the most likely candidates. It's that sort of statement, you know. Wait a minute, so you're saying they're the most likely? Or you're saying you're certain? Well, both. We're certain they're the most likely. Which means, I'm not going to say they are, but boy, it sounds like they are. That sort of stuff. So anyway, vehemently suspect of heresy. And he was never formally charged with heresy, because if he had been, he would have faced some kind of corporal punishment. That is, physical punishment. Like torture, like prison, I suppose. Whatever. And heresy, of course, they burnt people for heresy and hanged them as well. So he kind of saw sense and said, all right, I'm going to shut up on this. But it must be, how frustrating would that be, right? You're a scientist, right? And you discover something. And you discover something that's going to be of value to the whole world as far as advancing technology, moving into a more modern world and everything like this. And there's the church who are working on this dusty old book who says, nah, it ain't true. And we got the power. So forget what you've just found out. Forget the new science, the new understanding that you've got. You need to do what we tell you, or we'll torture you to death. That's how it was. I mean, that must have driven him crazy, whatever. Namely, he had opinions that the sun lies motionless at the centre of the universe, which is not quite right, but that the earth was not at its centre and moves, and that one may hold and defend an opinion as probable after it has been declared contrary to Holy Scripture. Well, I'm not quite sure how they got that out of Holy Scripture. I'm sure there are things in there, because you can pretty much interpret anything from Holy Scripture. But that was the problem. Nothing to do with astrology. Actually, it was to do with astronomy. And this is what we're looking at, is this split between astrology and astronomy. And because this article I've been kind of working on and following was done by astrologers, they kind of bend the truth a bit. Because it wasn't astrology, it was astronomy that he was found vehemently suspect of heresy for. But anyway, so at the end of it all, Galileo was required to abjure, curse, and detest those opinions, the opinions that the sun was at the center of the solar system and the earth went around it. Okay. So, as I said, at this point, it's worth mentioning that there's much confusion, which is both intentional and not, between astrology and astronomy. So, from skyandtelescope.com, Maria Temming in July 2014, she said, though the practices of astrology and astronomy have common roots, there is an important distinction in astrology versus astronomy today. Astronomy is the study of the universe and its contents outside of Earth's atmosphere. Astronomers examine the positions, motions, and properties of celestial objects. Now, astrology, with an L, astrology, attempts to study how those positions, motions, and properties affect people and events on Earth. And for several millennia, the desire to improve astrological predictions was one of the main motivations for astronomical observations and theories. So you get the idea. Astrology was taken as being seen as some kind of science, ancient science, by which you looked at the stars and this kind of thing, and you plotted their movements and you saw how they all fitted together up there in the cosmos. And then that meant you were able to predict things on Earth. So your better understanding of the stars meant your better understanding of their influence on people on Earth, if you follow Ptolemy and his book and all the sort of the edicts of astrology. The problem is, the more you study the stars, the more you start to come to a point of view of saying, oh, wait a minute, this is astronomy, this is not quite fitting with astrology, and the two start to diverge. Yeah. Because astrology was continued to be part of the mainstream science until the late 1600s. And again, Isaac Newton demonstrated some of the physical processes by which celestial bodies affect each other. And because he did that, and he also proved and re-energized this idea that we're not geocentric, we're, I don't know what the other version is, solar-centric. The sun is at the centre of the solar system. Earth moves around the sun. So what he did then, he showed that the same laws that make, say, an apple fall from the tree also apply to the motions of the celestial sphere. In other words, the Earth is held in place, its rotational path, by the gravity of the sun acting on Earth and the other planets too, which was different from what was understood in astrology. And of course, since that point where Newton came up with this stuff, astronomy has evolved into a completely separate field, where predictions about celestial phenomena are made and tested using the scientific method. Because you'll know when we've talked about things, especially the paranormal and stuff like that, that it's all about, does it meet the scientific method? Because if it doesn't meet the scientific method, they used to say that means it isn't true. Nowadays, they'll say it can't be accepted as science. So it's a pseudoscience. That's one of Wiki's favourite words. All right. So then what happened after that? Well, in the 17th, 18th century, which is also called the Age of Reason, the Protestant movement, reform movement, started in the mid-1500s, and then it abetted astrology's decline, because basically the Protestant movement was secular in the sense it didn't recognise spirituality, the paranormal, or the supernatural, anything like that. And astrology kind of fitted into that because it was kind of out there with almost a woo-woo thing, because somehow we're saying these things, those movements, those little tiny lights in the sky actually affected what went on here on Earth. And from that, rationalism became the popular consensus during the Age of Enlightenment, which was kind of like 1650 to about 1780. And so in Western European cafes and salons, they emphasize reason, analysis, and individualism. And of course, a lot of this was a reaction to excessive superstition, authority, and control from institutions such as the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church were losing their ground and their grip from that perspective of saying, this is what you should believe. Instead of being more what they are now, which is much more open and accepting and being the spiritual part of things, a connection to God, if you like, if you believe in that, right? What they were saying, this is it, we declare it, and you must follow it. So this kind of freedom from that position came. So skepticism and science were seen as a way to reform society. Because you've got this, the rules laid down by the church, by the state, by the aristocracy. And of course, revolutions in France, in England too. Don't forget the English Revolution started to pull away from that position of being told what to do. And science then provided a lot of that kind of information and understanding that moved things forward. Astrology was viewed more as mere entertainment and not a valid science. And most astrologers worked under pseudonyms because they could be attacked for their beliefs, because their beliefs were non-secular. They were, in a sense, religious or spiritualistic. So as we move on through time, we get to the 19th century. And again, this is from this article, which was written by astrologers, who said, renewed interest in spirituality and mysticism in England invigorate astrology again in Europe. Psychologist Carl Jung, all right, and he was one of the students of Sigmund Freud. He was 1875 to 1961. Pioneers the use of astrology in analysis, and other developments in the field are made. Not quite. And again, this is very biased because basically I think Jung used the use of astrology as an analogy for archetypes. Basically turning around and saying you could have archetypal human beings. So this person over there is this type of archetype. That kind of person over there is that kind of archetype, which kind of fits with the idea that in astrology you've got a Leo, a Gemini, a Scorpio person, right? So a Scorpio person, like myself, is going to behave in a certain way. So Jung was saying, well, in a sense, it's the same thing, because he would define an archetype in his psychoanalytical way to say this is how this type of person would act. But I'm not sure they actually used astrology. I've got a feeling that's something the astrologers have kind of sucked up and said, oh yeah, we are a science, look. You know, Carl Jung's uses it in psychoanalysis. And of course, as we all know, psychology is not a science either, because it's about the human mind, and the human mind is pretty indefinite and hard to understand. So it's not repeatable necessarily by the scientific method, which is used as a sort of yardstick by which you say, oh, this is science and this is pseudoscience, or not science at all. Psychology is kind of like there in the fringes, because, again, if you're dealing with human minds, often they are so complicated that it's not repeatable. Right? So anyway, just to get that one over. But, of course, then you move to the 20th, 21st century. And in the 1920s, newspapers and magazines began publishing the sun sign-based horoscopes that we still read today. What has always kind of made me smile is that if you look at those, and I've got to say, it's very much different than if you go to an astrologer for an appointment one-on-one. You actually get a lot of detailed information. They work out different charts for this, different charts for that, show you over a year, over 5 years, over 10 years, all this kind of thing. It's quite detailed. Not sure if it's real or not, but it is very detailed. But the ones you see in the newspaper are kind of funny, because they're basically saying there are 12 predictions for the entire population of the world. So you could divide the world into 12 and say, right, all these people are going to have a good week next week, and that 12th of the world's population are going to have a really sucky week next week. I mean, come on. Seriously? Just because they happen to have been born at a particular time in the horoscopic chart? But anyway, that's the way that is. And astrology would no doubt say, oh, but there's a lot more than that. And they'd say, because you're in one horoscopic part, but then there's planets that affect that and different angles of things that happen. And then there's what came before and what's coming after and so on. And the year you were born and stuff like this. So it's a lot more complicated. It's a whole formulaic process which they go through to produce these charts, which then do it, which is fascinating. I've had it once. Shia Must Be Obeyed got me that as a birthday present once, I think. And I went off to it, and it was absolutely fascinating, all these different things. And the lady I went with not only did charts and stuff, she also used computers to do it, to model these different things and so on. But I'm still not sure it was real. But there we are. That's just me. But let's have a look at those 12 horoscopic divisions. Because basically what they did was they said, well, look, the world is round, so it's 360 degrees, if you imagine looking out from the center to the equator. So we'll have a look at the major constellations, because there's lots of constellations. But we'll look at the major constellations that kind of sit on that center line. And then that'll be the 12 we'll divide it up to. And I'm going to explain a lot more about this in a moment. Anyway, so you've got Capricorn, the Sea Goat, which is December 22nd to January the 19th. So if you are born between those dates, that would make you a Capricorn. You've got Aquarius, the Water Bearer, January the 20th, February the 18th. Pisces, the Fish, February the 19th to March the 20th. Aries, the Ram, March 21st, April 19th. Taurus, the Bull, April 20 to May 20. Gemini, the Twins, May 21 to June 21. Cancer, the Crab, June 22 to July 22. Leo, the Lion, July 23 to August 22. Virgo, the Maiden, August 23 to September 22nd. Libra, the Scales, September 23 to October 22. Scorpio, the Scorpion, October 23 to November 21. And Sagittarius, Centaur, the Archer, November 22nd to December 21st. So that's the way all that works out.
Andy Way on Beetroot Radio.
And that's Beetroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And don't forget, all my shows are compressed into podcast at www.drandyhates.com. Very good. Oh, and don't forget my YouTube channel, which of course is the Incongruous channel. Look for the White Rabbit. And you'll find that heading on, getting still ticking along. People watching different stuff like this. Quite a range of things in there now. I don't know what I got in there. About 18 different videos that you might want to watch. Kind of interesting. Generally based on the show I've just done. And the last one I did was Dinosaurs to Dragons. So I just squeezed out that concept of, if you had a dinosaur, could you have ended up with a dragon, and could the dragon have survived, that sort of thing. And is that what we got as a dragon? You know, is that the way it was? Other than that, dragons came from space. Well, there we are. I guess David Icke was right. Anyway, we've just been through horoscopes, and I've read you out the names of the horoscopes and the dates they occur to, but not as easy as that. Things change all the time, and I think this is quite interesting because it really shows the problems with something like astrology. So anyway, from today.com, September 2016, NASA broke, the North American Space Agency, broke the news in a blog post that when the ancient Babylonians created the zodiac over 7,000 years ago, they wanted dates on the calendar to correspond with star constellations. There were 13 constellations, but they had a 12-month calendar, so they ditched one called Orpheus. Orpheus. Oh, what does that mean? Well, like I said, the 30 degrees around those constellations, the major constellations that come across the what they call the ecliptic, which is the kind of path of the sun over time. I don't really understand it terribly well, but basically that was it. The sun, path of the sun, would cross those what we now know as the horoscopes. But one that it did cross, although only across at the bottom, was this constellation called Orpheus, which they just said, well, we only want 12. So you are out. NASA also pointed out that the Earth's axis doesn't even point in the same direction as it did when the original constellations were drawn. So all our signs now have different date ranges now anyway. Now, from Inverse.com, Tanya Riley, September 2016. Orpheus, known in astrological terms as the Snake Bearer, is located between the constellations Aquila, Serpens, and Hercules, northwest of the Milky Way. On the south side of Orpheus is Scorpius to the west and Sagittarius to the east. The constellations seen in the northern sky in the summer, opposite to Orion, we'll be talking about Orion in a bit. During the winter, in the northern hemisphere, the constellation remains invisible to most latitudes, which is another reason they may not have wanted to use it. Now, the Earth's axis has shifted in the past 3,000 years, so the days used for the original zodiac no longer align with the path of the sun. And according to this, 86% of people currently identify as the wrong astrological signs. Ain't that interesting? Now, while they may make cool patterns in the Earth's sky, like a bear, for example, there is no evidence that the stars in a constellation are related at all. In fact, stars are always moving, but the changes are so infinitesimally small that they're almost impossible for humans to notice in their lifestyle. So there are new dates. And I tell you what, let me give you those dates. Now we've talked about it. Because let's say there's 13 now astrological, you know, horoscopal signs, horoscopical, whatever the word would be. So your new dates, if you're Capricorn, January 20th to February the 16th, Aquarius, February the 16th to March the 11th. Pisces, March the 11th to April the 18th. Aries, April the 18th to May the 13th. Taurus, May the 13th to June 21st. Gemini, June 21st to July 20th. Cancer, July 30th to August 10th. Leo, August 10th to September 16th. Virgo, September 16th to October 30. Libra, October 30 to November 23. Scorpio would now be November 23 to the 29th. So, only a little tiny one on Scorpio. Ophiuchus, the new one, the snake bearer, would be from November the 29th to December the 17th. And Sagittarius, Centaur the archer, would be December the 17th to January the 20th. Well, it kind of makes it interesting when people say, oh, typical Capricorn or typical Sagittarian, because it would all change now if you took those new things. So let's look at that. All right, let's look at it. So, this writing's tiny. For Aries, the ram, they would say that's ruled by Mars, the god of war. It's a cardinal fire sign. It shows aggression, leadership, enterprise, warfare, anger, beginnings. Aries is the first sign in the zodiac. So impulse, passion, inspiration, rapid movement, and vengeance. And by the way, I got this from Roche Joy D. Allenday, whose teacher was Mr. Lim. And this is from Araling Panil Punan. So it's actually almost like a Hindu type source. Taurus the bull, ruled by Venus, the goddess of love, fixed earth sign. It shows stability, stagnation, beauty, pleasure, material things, love, debauchery, money, prosperity, maintenance of status quo, real estate, and stubbornness. Gemini the twins, ruled by Mercury, the trickster, messenger god. Mutable air sign. Communication, cleverness, trickery, commerce, analysis, reason, dispersal, intellect, dispute, and changeability. Of course, a lot of these things are contrary. If you're one, then how can you be the other? But there we are. Cancer the crab, ruled by the moon, the lesser luminary, cardinal water sign. Intense emotion, rapid movement, changeability, love of travel, need for variety, oracles and divination, adaptability, hidden things, beginnings. Cancer is a cardinal sign. Leo the lion, ruled by the sun, the greater luminary, fixed fire sign, royalty, nobility, stability, stagnation, inspiration, passion, leadership, maintenance of status quo, stubbornness, the same as Taurus the bull. Virgo, the virgin, ruled by Mercury, the trickster messenger god. We've already had trickster messenger god. Oh, that's Mercury, that's why. Ha ha, stupid me, sorry. Communication, material things, tangible reality, intellect, analysis, cleverness, trickery, commerce, real estate, changeability. Libra, the scales, ruled by Venus, goddess of love, cardinal air sign. Beauty, pleasure, intellect, communication, aesthetic senses, love, debauchery again, analysis, reason, and beginnings. Scorpio. I used to be Scorpio. Now I'm not anymore. What did I say I am now? If I'm not Scorpio, then I would have been... So I'm Libra now. I'm not sure I like that. I used to like being Scorpio. Anyway, Scorpio the Scorpion. Ruled by Mars, the god of war, fixed water sign. Warfare, aggression, intense emotion, hidden things, maintenance of status quo again, vengeance and stubbornness. A lot of stubbornness, isn't there? Sagittarius the archer, ruled by Jupiter. I don't know why. Oh, I see. Sagittarius the archer, ruled by Jupiter, the greater benefit. Mutable fire sign, expansion, learning, changeability, passion, inspiration, foreign countries, religion. Capricorn, the water goat, ruled by Saturn, the greater malefic, cardinal earth sign. Leadership, restriction, imitation, rapid movement, material things, tangible reality, real estate beginnings. Aquarius, the water bearer, ruled by Saturn, the greater malefic fixed air sign. Stability, stagnation, maintenance of the status quo, stubbornness, restriction, limitation, intellect, analysis, communication, and cleverness. Boy, Aquarius haven't got much going for it, really, except intellect and cleverness. And finally, Pisces the fish, ruled by Jupiter, the greater beneficial, the mutable water sign. Religion, expansion, learning, changeability, intense emotion, hidden things, endings. Pisces is the last sign of the zodiac. So there you go. And that sort of says, well, if it's all changed, kind of, is it that important? Is it solid somehow? Does it all kind of fit together? I don't know, because they've said that Aries is the first one. So for some reason, they've said, okay, we're going to start on, in the first instance, March 21st, for some reason. And that's where they're going to put the line. And then they're going to go around every 30 degrees along the equator and chop it up that way. Well, it doesn't really sound very spiritual, does it, in that way? And then we're going to assign these qualities to each of those areas. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about this. And that's part of my issue with astrology. But it's just me. So the question would be is then why didn't they use some of the bigger constellations? Or why didn't they use one that's really kind of important and significant when we look at ancient stuff around the world? And that would be the one of those would be the constellation of Orion the Hunter, which is a big constellation. It's a southern constellation sitting below constellation Taurus and above constellation Leops. Orion spans nearly 20 degrees of the zodiac in the sign of Gemini. Well, you'd think all of that was important, but they decided not to use it. So you're wondering, is it about the position in the sky more than what stars are actually in that constellation? Because Orion's got three stars in it, right? So if we were to say, okay, so what's up there in the constellations? That's the kind of thing we're interested in. So we are interested in the specific stars. So there are three stars in Orion's belt, for example, which is one of the few things I could spot in the sky. You'll recall I talked about that earlier on in the show. So the first star is known as Alnitak. It's also known as Zeta Orionis, which makes sense. But it's not a single star, it's a triple star. Now, of course, back in the day when astrology was first thought of, and too much probably up until the 20th or even 21st century, they didn't know it was a triple star because they didn't have telescopes that could see that well. Does that make a difference to the reading? Does it make a difference to the importance? This is kind of what I'm saying. It's a triple star. It's located in the eastern end of the belt, Orion. It's 736 light years distance from Earth. Okay, and I'm using this as an example of how the stars are formed, how the constellations are formed. This is Orion the Hunter. And is there any relevance to their shape, size, position, stuff like this? 736 light years distance from Earth. It's over 100,000 times more luminous than the Sun. So it's incredibly bright. It's a primary component in the Alnitak system. Is a close binary star composed of a blue supergiant and a blue dwarf. And just to compare that with our sun is known as a yellow dwarf star. Right? So this is a blue supergiant because it's so big. The supergiant has a mass about 27 times that of the sun and a diameter 19 times solar. It is the brightest O-class star in the sky. And I don't want to explain what an O-class star is. Look it up. Ain't got time. Because this stuff is so complicated. The study of astronomy is so complicated. There were so many different types of stars and the way they work and the luminosity and stuff like this. But anyway, it's the brightest O-class star in the sky. It has a luminosity 180,000 times solar. So it's amazingly brighter. Now, the little old blue dwarf that's there was only discovered in 1999, but I said it was a little old blue dwarf. Actually, it's 19 times solar, which means it's 19 times bigger than our sun. And has a radius 7.5 times that of the sun. So it's big, but it's considered to be a dwarf, just like our sun is a yellow dwarf. Now, the third component in the Alnitak system, so this is just the first star we're talking about in Orion's belt that we can see with the eyes. It's a fourth magnitude BO type star. Like I said, I'm not going to explain that, which orbits the main pair every 1500 years. So it's way out there orbiting around, but it is part of it. And there may even be a ninth magnitude star along the same line of sight. But they're unclear whether it's actually related to the system or it's just an optical companion. In other words, you can see it right there, but it's away behind it or something like that, and not actually gravitationally bound to Alnitak. So Alnilam is the middle one. It's also known as Epsilon or Orionis, the middle star. And it's located at a distance of 1,340 light years from Earth. Well, that's almost twice as far as the first one, Alnitak. Well, why would we consider that? Because we consider the belt as being a straight line. But if you can imagine, the first star is 736 light years away. The second star is 1,340 light years away. So it's way much further away. And the star is, again, it's a large blue supergiant with a visual magnitude of 1.7. It's between 7, and it changes, but it's between 275,000 and 832,000 as luminous as the sun. So extraordinarily bright, which is why it looks like it's the same as the one next to it. And it's 30 to 64.5 times as massive. And the reason the figures are ranges, of course, is because it's so far away. It's over 1,000 light years away from Earth, so it's hard to see and hard to work out its exact proportions. But, and it pulses. It has different pulses and stuff like this, so that's one of the reasons it's hard to define. Now, the third one is known as Mintaka, which is also known as Delta Orionis. It's the westernmost star of Orion Belt, and it's a binary star. So we're talking about six stars that look like three. Yeah? And this one's 916 light years from Earth. So you've got one at 736, you've got one at 1,340, and you've got one at 916. They're not in a straight line at all, are they? They just look like they're in a straight line from where we are sitting in the universe. So they've got no relationship to each other. This is what I'm kind of saying about the constellations, because they're all done by line of sight. When you actually know the astronomical data about them, they're not actually connected in any way. So you could draw pretty pictures around, here's a bear, here's a crab, here's a scorpion. But really, because of the distances between all these planets, they're not connected at all. So what difference would that make in the study or the application of astrology? Because these things aren't even, you know, you tend to think Taurus the bull is the bullish type of person. So it acts more like a bull. But in actual fact, the bull that we're seeing wouldn't be a bull if you looked at it from somewhere in the universe. It might be some completely different shape altogether. Would that shape of the bull actually have an effect on people on the Earth? We'll keep going on this. So, okay. So the Orion constellation can easily be found in the sky from November to February. For observers in the northern hemisphere, the constellation lies in the southwestern sky. But the Orion constellation, particularly Orion's belt, was very, very important to ancient peoples. Many, many ancient peoples. And I'll just give you two examples. The pyramids, for example, Orion's belt looked almost the same at ancient times as it does now. So that's what we're actually seeing. Now, the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau, right, the Great Pyramid and the other two, simulate the alignment of the three belt stars. And the air shafts inside the pyramids point towards Orion's constellation. So we kind of assume that the Egyptians knew this, if it was the Egyptians that built the pyramids, by the way. Whoever built the pyramids knew this and built the pyramids in that way so that everything would line up like that. So obviously Orion was very important to them. And you've kind of got to ask, well, why isn't that got something to do with astrology? Because it was that important to people that then that they build these enormous objects, millions of stones, stuff like this, aligned to Orion, and yet astrology doesn't even include Orion. Weird, isn't it? Now, we talked about the air shafts, and this is a fairly modern archaeology, actually. Boy, I got a real cough, haven't I? We said that's more modern archaeology, but the air shafts, the theory is that they're there to project the pharaoh's soul towards Orion, because Orion was such a significant thing to them. Now, there's another place called Teotihuacan, and it's the ruins of an ancient temple of Teotihuacan, which lies 35 miles northeast of Mexico City. And it's two large pyramids and a temple believed to have been built in the 2nd century BC. And they point directly towards Orion's belt, and their layout mimics that of the three stars, the three belt stars. Orion's belt, right? The construction of the ancient city was attributed to a race of giants. Well, I've done a show on the giants, so check that out. And these were known as the Quinametsin giants, 10 feet tall, 600 pounds, they estimated, who were believed to have populated the world in an earlier era. And the Pyramid of the Sun, just out of interest, the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan is exactly half as tall as the Great Pyramid of Giza. Makes you think, doesn't it? And again, the question is, if Orion was so important, why isn't it part of astrology?
Andy Way on Beatroot Radio.
Which is community radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And let's continue with astrology. Okay. So what I thought I'd do is, because I'm getting to the point now, you can see what I did with Orion's belt. And I'm saying, well, it's so far away. We only see it as a belt. Even though it's important, we see it in the pyramids at Giza. We see it in Teotihuacan, right, in Mexico. It's obviously was important, yet that's not part of astrology. So what is this thing that's actually acting on people? Do you get what I mean? What is this thing that is actually doing stuff to people? Could it be some kind of electromagnetic force that's coming from these planets? Could it be some kind of gravitational thing? Some other thing like that? Because they're not even related to the pictures that we see, only for us at our position in the universe. I guess over time, the pictures would actually disappear. And that's what NASA was saying, that they don't even line up anymore. The dates aren't even relevant anymore because things have moved so much, and the axis of the Earth has changed since then. So what is this astrology thing that we're doing? Really? I mean, I want to keep an open mind and I want to be supportive of something that might fit in that sort of paranormal category because that's my stuff. But really, it's kind of hard to find something here since astrology deviated from astronomy. So what I thought was, well, let's look at something that we might be able to draw some thoughts about its relationship to humans on Earth, and see if that gives us a clue as to what's going on with astrology. Got it. Okay. So now I thought we'd look at the moon, because the moon is the nearest object in space. It's quite likely it's not even a moon, actually. It's quite likely that the Earth has its own planet that is going around, because it's way too big for a moon, as far as most other moons are concerned. But anyway, let's talk about it. So according to Wiki, the lunar effect, and you know Wiki always goes for the skeptical point of view. That seems to be their mantra, and I think they've been told that that's what they're meant to do. But the lunar effect is a real or imaginary correlation between specific stages of the roughly 29.5-day lunar cycle and behaviour and physiological changes in living beings on Earth, including humans. Now, they say, and it's weird, this is Wiki for you, right? A considerable number of studies have examined the effect on humans, have found no correlation between the lunar cycle and human biology or behaviour. I'm really sorry. However, they then go on to say that lots of other studies that do show that. It's really weird. Anyway, that's Wiki. So, mental illness is one. Now, two studies found evidence that those with the mental disorder of schizophrenia generally exhibit increased violent or aggressive episodes during the full moon. Well, that's kind of what we all thought, isn't it? Anyway, epilepsy, right? A study into epilepsy found a significant negative correlation between the mean number of seizures per day and the fraction of the moon that is illuminated. But this correlation disappeared when the local clarity of the night sky was controlled for, so not the lunar phase per se that influences the occurrence of epileptic seizures with advanced photosensitive epilepsy. So what they're basically trying to say there is that it's all to do with the clarity of the sky and therefore the amount of light that was coming through, and not necessarily how much of the moon was illuminated. Okay, so it's all more to do with the amount of light, they say. But they haven't really proved that the amount of the moon has a difference or not. But anyway. But we do hear a lot from things like Law and Order, don't we? And senior police officers in Brighton, UK, announced June 2007 that they were planning to deploy more officers over the summer to counter trouble they believe is linked to the lunar cycle. This followed research by the Sussex Police Force that concluded there was a rise in violent crime when the moon was full. A spokesman for the police force said, "Research carried out by us has shown a correlation between violent incidents and the full moon." Well, kind of believe the coppers, don't we? A police officer responsible for the research told the BBC that, "From my experience of 19 years of being a police officer, undoubtedly on full moons, we do seem to get people with strange behaviour, more fractious and argumentative." Police in Ohio and Kentucky have blamed temporary rises in crime on the full moon. And in January 2008, New Zealand's Justice Minister, Annett King, suggested that a spate of stabbings in the country could have been caused by the lunar cycle. So, and of course, this is just a selection from many different anecdotal, experiential statements about things. But, I mean, the fact is that, you know, the police in Brighton actually carried out research. So, no doubt, they documented and produced a report. Well, that's science, isn't it? So, scientifically, they're saying, yeah, there is some kind of evident correlation. Sorry, I'm fighting with this cough. Maybe I'm coming down with a cold or something. Maybe it's the moon. It's probably the moon that's doing it. That's the problem right there. Now, something close to my heart. Motorcycle fatalities. A study of 13,029 motorcyclists killed in nighttime crashes found that there were more than 5.3% more fatalities on nights with a full moon compared to other nights. The authors speculate that the increase might be due to visual distractions created by the moon, especially when it is near the horizon or appears abruptly between trees, around turns, etc. Now, this is the kind of study that you'll often see that's done by, I don't know, doctoral students or something like this, when it's pretty obvious that that's not what they're saying. But they know that if they want to be considered serious, taken seriously by the university, they can't turn around and say that there's some woo-woo factor from the moon that's affecting it. Now, it could be more because, of course, the moon's gravitational field does have an effect on the Earth. So it could be something like that. But they're not going to say about that. So then they start talking about, oh, well, it might have flashed between trees and around turns. Doesn't sound very believable to me. But it does sound believable that there is this difference in motorcycles being killed in nighttime crashes when the moon's out. Now, as far as politics is concerned, a guy called Guy Kramer, president of the aerospace science company United Dynamics Corp, so big deal, he said that the full moon might have influenced voter behavior in the US 2000 presidential election. Well, that's amazing. So we've got the full moon acting on things, and we've got all these Russian bots they keep inventing and talking about. Plus each other's involvement, plus Facebook, plus Twitter and all this kind of thing. Of course, that's what we're going to get with our latest election, aren't we? Let's hope it's not a full moon. Now, the stock market. Several studies have argued that the stock market's average returns are much higher during the half of the month closest to the new moon than the half closest to the full moon. The reasons have not been studied, but the authors suggest this is due to lunar influences on mood. Oh, wait a minute. So we're saying that's a thing. Lunar influences have mood. So the moon may have influences on mood. Is that possible? Sleep quality. A July 2013 study carried out at the University of Basel in Switzerland suggests a correlation between the full moon and human sleep quality. Okay, and that's a study, again, carried out by a university. That would be science, wouldn't it? Okay. Professor Kajochen and colleagues presented evidence that a lunar rhythm can modulate sleep structure in humans when measured under the highly controlled conditions of a circadian laboratory study protocol without time cues. What does that mean? Well, you'll understand when we go through this explanation. Studying 33 volunteer subjects, the researchers found that the subjective and objective measures of sleep varied according to lunar phase and thus may reflect human circadian rhythmicity. What does that mean? Circadian rhythmicity is presumably the cycles of the moon. Measures of lunar influence on sleep structure electroencephalographic activity during non-rapid eye movement sleep, which is known as NREM, obviously, and secretion of the hormones melatonin and cortisol were retrospectively analysed. Around full moon, it was found that EEG delta activity during NREM sleep, an indicator of deep sleep, increased by 30%. Time to fall asleep increased by 5 minutes, and EEG assessed total sleep duration was reduced by 20 minutes. The changes were associated with a decrease in subjective sleep quality and diminished melatonin levels. And this guy, Cajetan, said, "The lunar cycle seems to influence human sleep even when one does not see the moon and is not aware of the actual moon phase." So there's something about the influence of the moon, at least, that affects human sleep. So the question is could it affect, could the celestial objects also create human mood as it does with sleep? So in animals, the California grunion fish have an unusual mating and spawning ritual during the spring and summer months. The egg laying takes place on 4 consecutive nights, beginning on the night of the full and new moons when tides are highest. However, this is a well-known understood reproductive strategy that is more related to tides than it is to lunar phase. And you can kind of understand that perhaps it's better for the grunion fish to lay their eggs at high tide so they can get higher up in the rocks or something like that, or low tide when they can get lower in the rocks. But it also happens to correlate with the lunar phases because the tides are highest when the sun, earth and moon are aligned, i.e. at new moon or full moon. And that also suggests, of course, when planets are aligned, the sun, the earth and the moon, which are close to each other in sort of cosmic proportions, that is going to have definitely an increased gravitational effect. Okay. In insects, the lunar cycle may affect hormonal changes in phylogenesis. So the body weight of honeybees peaks during the new moon. And the midge, Clunio marinus, has a biological clock synchronized with the moon. Interesting. Now, of course, this might be because it's a nocturnal animal and it's better for it to, for example, mate and find its mate when there's a full moon. But maybe it's something else. This is what we're talking about. Spawning of coral Platygyra lamellia occurs at night in the Red Sea in a 3 to 5 day period around the new moon in July and the similar period in August. Acropora coral time their simultaneously release of sperm and eggs to just 1 or 2 days a year after sundown with a full moon. So again, there's lots of reasons, and you could say, if you lean towards the scientific side, that it's all to do with the light of the moon. And so, you know, even if your eggs hatch out, then your little babies are going to see their way better and they might survive better in a full moon. Or the other side of things, you don't want them to hatch out in a full moon so that they're less hard to see by predators. Here's an interesting one. The Palolo worm that lives in the seas of Indonesia and Polynesia lose the terminal part of their bodies during a waning moon at certain time of year. These parts float to the surface and release sperm and eggs. Now, the terminal parts are gathered by the local people as a special food. The event would be predicted by local priests, and the lunar activity was set by the event. Now, because the Palolo enter their spawning time between October and November, and because of inter-island differences in spawning times, there are factors other than the moon that control the timing. Such factors may include seawater temperatures, tides, weather, and other biological signals. But One of the things I found interesting about this is that it was the local priests that would predict the events. And they would probably predict the event because of the lunar calendar they set up, which is kind of what astrology used to provide in the old days. The monitoring of the seasonal cycles and stuff like that. And that was the value of astrology. And then astrologers went further and actually made divinations and predictions. Finally, on this section, in 2000, the year 2000, a retrospective study in the United Kingdom reported an association between the full moon and significant increases in animal bites to humans. That's interesting, isn't it? And of course, that makes you think back to Lon Chaney and the werewolves and things like this. Just read that again. An association between the full moon and significant increases in animal bites to humans. The study reported that patients presented to the A&E with injuries stemming from bites from an animal rose significantly at the time of a full moon in 1997 to 1999, which was the period of the study. The study concluded that animals have an increased inclination to bite a human during a full moon period. Well, isn't that interesting? That animals would be affected by the moon. And again, the question comes up. Could things that are further away have a similar influence on humans or animals or whatever it is? And therefore, the influence of the stars is direct from the stars, from their alignments, from their positions, from their position in the sky. And also then they affected you when you were born, because those dates at which you were born puts you in a horoscopic category, whether that's with 12 horoscopic divisions or 13 horoscopic divisions and the different dates and so on. Could that have affected you all the way through your life? Gotta wonder. So this is Andy Y on Dr. Andy Yates on the Andy Y Show, Beatroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And don't forget, my podcasts of these shows is available on www.drandyyates.com, and you will see some kind of a thought dump, download, opinion, whatever it is, on YouTube, on the Incongruous channel. Get me easier and easier to find as I put more and more videos out there. And that's just a little 20-minute thing that you could have a look at yourself. Don't forget, if you like it or if you appreciate my efforts, please like, share and subscribe. And then that way it's slowly growing. It'd be great if it grew some more, because then more people get a chance to look at it. Whatever, you get the idea. So, okay, so we've been talking about astrology, and you've probably got the feeling that I even though I'm open-minded, even though I've seen some pretty wild things in my life, and I still stay open-minded to them, astrology I almost see as if when it deviated and split apart from astronomy, so the pure study of the cosmology, the stars, the celestial objects, all of that, this interpretation of those things. I mean, could that be something else? I don't know. Because we talked about the moon, and the moon is very close to us, really, comparatively, in cosmic, sizes. It's actually 384,000 kilometres, which is 240,000 miles-ish, or 1.28 light seconds away from Earth. So it takes 1.28 seconds for light to get to us from the moon. So it's pretty close in cosmic sort of measures. And we've discussed its at least fairly subtle effect on Earth. Certainly affects the tides and things like this, does affect plants, animals and stuff like this, more likely to get bitten. Also affects humans, affects their sleep. It's been done in scientific studies. So you can't argue about this. It does have effects. Whether that effect is from its gravitational pull, like in the case of gravity, or its light, as in the case of the poor old epileptics, or something else, we don't know. But of course, it is close to us, right? Now, if you took the nearest planet, okay, even though I said the moon might be a planet, but the nearest planet to us in the solar system is Mars. And for as an example, it's 56 million kilometers away. And we said that the moon is 384,000 kilometers away. So actually, it's 146 times further away from the moon. So you could say, well, we'd have 146 times less influence from Mars than we have from the moon. And the moon is a kind of a subtle influence in many respects. So Mars, which is 146 miles away, people say Mars is in your horoscope sign or whatever, or Mars is in conjunction with something else. But it's 146 times further away. Could it possibly have a direct influence? I'm just saying, seems unlikely. And then if you go to somewhere like Orion's Belt, which is what we were talking about, right? And we look at Alnitak, which is one of the ones, probably the nearest, actually. It's 736 light years from the Earth, which, looking at the numbers, is actually 13 trillion times further away than the moon. Well, there's not a chance that could be having any direct effect. It's gravity, it's electromagnetic, it's Higgs field, it's 0.4, whatever that is. 13 trillion times further away than the moon, which has a subtle effect. Divide that by 13 trillion. You get the idea, right? It's incredibly unlikely, so much so as to be almost impossible, I would say. Again, just my opinion, but I don't think so. So it must be something else. If astrology, trying to be fair now, if astrology does have some effectiveness, does have something, then it acts as a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that if you have a divination or some kind of prediction or something for this, that once that's set in motion, this creates a kind of energy, a creative energy that manifests itself into the future. So if you went to see an astrologer and the astrologer says, well, I see this in your chart, that in your chart, and the other in the chart, and you go away thinking that those things are in your chart, you may be creating that by projecting your energy into the future and manifesting that. All right, so that's one way of looking at it. Of course, astrology provides a pseudo-scientific basis for psychic revelation, if you believe in that. That is more acceptable than just psychic consultation. So somebody may not go to a psychic, but they might go to an astrologer because it sounds much more scientific. They might not get as far as going to see Gypsy Rose Lee or something with the bigger gold earrings, but they might be okay to go in somebody who's got a computer and does these charts and stuff like this. Feels a lot better and so on. But the person, the astrologer, may be just a psychic. And all this other kind of gymnastics that they're doing on the computer and everything actually doesn't mean a thing. That's a possibility, isn't it? At least it's a possibility. So in fact, the astrologer is a psychic and is making a psychic prediction as of the person's future. Okay. Now, studying astrological charts and techniques in the course of a consultation connects the astrologer to some kind of universal energy. So again, the astrologer has some psychic cosmic connection out there to the universe, and that gives them a sense of direction and influence, which they then pass on to the client. So if they're looking towards the client's future, they may, by their connection to the universe, get some kind of feedback as to what's going to happen to the client. You see what I mean? I'm sure you do. But of course, again, the astrologer and the universe, not astrology, is the source of the information. And the other problem is, of course, if once you start putting things into categories and saying Leo is this and Leo does that and so on, like Leos are aggressive drivers, they like to be the center of attention. But then you find out, well, it was pretty arbitrary when they decided that Leo should have been one of the constellations. And now NASA tells us that the dates are wrong, so you may not be a Leo, or you might be a new Leo. It does sound all a bit kind of vague and random to me. Or at least, that's kind of what I think. This is Dr. Andy Yates on the Andy Wise Show on Beatroot Radio, Community Radio for Rushton and the Nen Valley. And as usual, it's been my pleasure to present this information to you. And again, it's up to you to make your decision on astrology. I've presented some information to you, see what you think. I think my opinion probably came through a little bit there. But again, I'm still open-minded because I'm always ready for somebody to prove me wrong. Or, you know, to enhance my knowledge of things and stuff like this. And that's the way I think everybody should be. Open-minded. Check it out. Don't forget to check my podcasts out. www.drandyyates.com. Don't forget to check out my YouTube videos on the Incongruous channel. And then it's up to me to say, please have a great rest of the weekend. And of course, please take care.